You are listening to Devil We Know, a true crime podcast, which may contain adult themes, explicit language, and graphic depictions of violence. Portions of this show may be traumatic for those under 18. Listener discretion is advised.
In this episode of Devil We Know, a woman named Becky goes up a hill and over it in a dramatic fashion, starting with torrid affairs and ending with an episode of murderous behavior. Her husband, Keith Bryan, fell victim to all of her treacherous choices in a flurry of actions that sent his world spinning. Rebecca Louise Reddick was a woman for whom goodness had been a given. From her birth in May of 1959, Rebecca, or Becky, as she was often called, lived in Oklahoma City with her parents, Jim and Vernell. She was the youngest of the household, the baby sister, of two biological brothers, David and Tim, as well as one foster sister named Gloria, who later came to be a permanent part of the family. Gloria joined the family at age 9 when her own mother gave her up, and both she and Becky became, in the spirit of the old expression, as thick as thieves. They were close in age and did almost everything together. Becky attended Cherokee Hills Christian School in 9th and 10th grade, and she then finished high school at Mustang High, where she and Gloria both graduated in 1977. After this milestone, the two found an apartment and rented it together, leading up to Becky's stint at Southwestern Oklahoma State University and good old Oklahoma State University. It was also around this time that Becky began seeing a man only a year her senior by the name of Keith Bryan. Keith, who was born south to the Sooner State in Dallas, Texas, had moved to Oklahoma City in his late childhood. In high school, Keith had maintained the football athlete bad boy persona, the polar opposite of Becky's good girl conventional outlook. Still, these opposites attracted, and after a short meet-cute in a park in spring of 78, the two were well on their way to creating a family together. The couple was married the next year, and it wasn't long before Keith became more of the good guy to compliment Becky. He joined the fire department in 1980, working for 11 years toward the eventual promotion as chief, where he served another 20. He too attended Oklahoma State, and he became the owner of his very own construction business. Keith's involvement in the community was another trait much appreciated and highly recognized. He was a member of the Metro Association of Fire Chiefs, past president of the Oklahoma State Fire Chiefs Association, and a recipient of a Responder of the Year Heroism Award in 1999. Keith and Becky, even early on, had the right mix to begin their conjoined life anew. Soon after marrying, the couple had two boys, Kent and Trent, who enjoyed an uneventful and pleasant childhood. The family went to a local church named Bridge Church, and the couple was active there, even teaching Sunday school. For 8 years, starting in 1990, Becky was also the office manager for the church, and she began to attend college again, this time at Oklahoma City Community College. There, she studied general finance, and in 2003, she also began working on the requisites for a real estate license as well. She had attended two separate iterations of the Charles Barnes Real Brokers license course in 2003 and 2007 and then again in 2009. She began working as a licensed broker with Coldwell Banker as one of the top sellers and highest on the commission scale. Her regular work in the field of real estate not only gave her quite the financial padding though, it also gave her opportunities to travel. She took these, and soon it fed into a very different result of her career. Becky was changing as a person. This quintessential good girl had turned, in a short amount of time, into a smoker and drinker, and she apparently now had a sailor's mouth to boot. She was even snooty and mean-spirited in reference to Trent's fiance and later wife, a staple that not all suited the mother Trent knew and loved. In the mix, though, was Becky's inclination to infidelity, and for Becky, there was a lot of that. Becky attended one real estate conference in the summer of 2009 that helped her change her life forever. It wasn't so much in the networking or the career tips and workshopping that she used to do that, however. It was instead her relationship with a man named Mark Holbrook, whom she met at the conference, that allowed her to transition from a good girl to an all-out bad wife. Mark, from Hugo, Oklahoma, had his own family. But the two still made a go at their own little secret affair, sleeping together only that same fall. The two would meet halfway between Mustang and Hugo in order to spend time together, always getting rooms at different hotels in the same area. These secret weekends together ended only months later, at the new year of 2010. Mark had decided that he was still in love with his own wife, and that he wanted to make things work. This was in spite of the fact that he had told his wife that he wanted a divorce. His relationship with Becky was already falling into disrepair too, as Mark stated that she was constantly stirring things up and acting in a manipulative manner. It was hard to reconcile that kind of behavior with the effort that it took to leave his wife, and the fact that he still loved her hung heavy on his heart. So Mark called it off, and Becky, for her part, became incredibly obsessive. She would regularly visit his work and house to harass him, and her text messages kept coming despite the fact that Mark ignored them all. Mark eventually told Keith about the affair himself, admitting that he and Becky had been sleeping together, at which point Keith simply resolved to work on the marriage. He took the news well, of course, but Becky, who had simply snapped, did not. Becky then called Mark's home and told his wife and sons about the affair, and she even left Mark a voicemail to tell him that she was now pregnant. Mark, though, counted this as false news immediately. He knew that Becky was 51, so there was no way she was having the baby. He ignored her message, and Becky continued with her charade, even telling a close friend that she was going to get a pregnant lady to take a test and send the stick to Mark to scare him. She spent her time planning a fake birth announcement and choosing names for a child that didn't and wouldn't exist. For 3 or 4 months after the breakup, Mark ignored her, and for 3 or 4 months, Becky continued with her harassment. It wasn't until 2011 that more of Mark would come out of the woodwork in Becky's life. But little did he know, she wasn't gone just yet. Becky wasn't simply losing her mind in her relationship with Mark, though. The life she had built with Keith had also taken a swan dive. Although the separation was amicable thanks to Keith's understanding nature, Becky still filed for divorce and moved out of their home into a condo. Keith, though, didn't agree with the divorce and still wanted to try and work it out. The two attended counseling, and for a while it seemed as though there was a breakthrough. Becky claimed that the couple's therapy was working, and Keith felt like a changed man. They were on dates again, with Keith wooing her and complimenting her as if they were newly together. Many agreed that this time together was the best their relationship had ever been. That wasn't all, though. Becky then decided to move back home, and she had the divorce case fully dismissed. It was as if the couple had a new lease on life, a fresh outlook, and a way to reconcile all the unpleasantness that had passed. But unfortunately, that wasn't exactly the case. In February of 2011, Becky had begun some of her old antics, namely harassing Mark and his family once more, even calling his wife and his parents to stir up the bygone affair and its aftermath. Although she had moved back in with Keith, she was still telling Mark that she loved him, and it was even more evident that the couple's therapy, the counseling that Becky went through, hadn't done anything but postpone a yet another episode of some bubbling, emerging hysteria. Months later, she began writing a love letter to Mark, and in August, she stuck it in a desk drawer in her office before later driving by his work again. The proverbial old dog had yet to learn new tricks, it would seem. But this wasn't all. There was one drastic change in Becky that had yet to take place until a month later, during the dates of September 19th and 20th of 2011. During these dates, Becky went on yet another trip to a real estate conference, this time in Tulsa, Oklahoma. She became flirty with several of the men in the conference, sending nudes first to a fellow agent named Carl Olderman, who gladly reciprocated. She would send texts saying, "Ride this, cowboy," as she presented him with nude pictures of herself, But she didn't stop there. She went to other real estate brokers at the conference to solicit more sexual favors, including a man named Bill Weitzcarver. Bill was a realtor too, and his fiancée had also come to attend the conference. Bill refused and rejected Becky's advances regularly throughout this time there, and Becky simply wouldn't take no for an answer, until finally she responded with a text that read, "You are probably making a good decision. You probably would have fallen in love with me." It wasn't just for the realtors that Becky reserved these 2 days of sexual pursuits, though. On her way home from the conference, she stopped by the house of one client she had had in the past, a man named Wesley Hubert. Wesley, though, did not follow Bill's example. Instead, he engaged in sexual relations with Becky, who was then on her way back to the house in Mustang, the house where she and Keith had lived. We'll be right back after this message from our sponsor. I spend most of my time reading up on true crime and finding new ways to bring you the most chilling stories. But when I want to take myself away from the world of deadly killers, I like to make time for fun. The way I do that is by pulling out my phone and playing the puzzle game known as Best Fiends. With Best Fiends, you can solve the puzzles anywhere, engaging your brain and getting to take on challenges of all kinds. Best of all, it's a casual game. You can put it back down when you need to and start the game again without skipping a beat. Whether it's just for the level you're on, or whether it's to tell people like me, your favorite character is Gordon the Scorpion, Best Fiends is a game you can easily share and enjoy talking about on social media as well. In only a few days, I've made it all the way to level 50. I've been working, of course, but the thing is, I can pick it up and put down Best Fiends whenever I want. I've been playing after long shifts at work or even after recording my podcast. When I have a free moment and want to charge my brain a bit with some fun activity, playing this game takes the cake, and it sure beats hanging out on the internet all day. There's no need for an internet connection, so I am able to play even when I'm flying from place to place or when I'm in a place with no signal. I can't help but watch the game too. It's all fun and lively in a way that makes the world of true crime even fade away for a few minutes. And the game doesn't get boring, because there's always more content coming in every month to keep me interested. Engage your brain with fun puzzles and collect tons of cute characters. Trust me, with over 100 million downloads, this 5-star rated mobile puzzle game is a must play. Download Best Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Friends without the R, Best Fiends. Becky had spent the night of the 20th acting even more strangely than usual. She was calling Mark again. And since he no longer recognized the number, he answered. It wasn't until he heard her voice that Mark hung up, and Becky took the option of leaving him a voicemail, which stated that she still loved him and wanted to be near him. The voicemail, which Mark heard later, made it sound as though Becky had been drinking, and she told Mark in the message that she was planning on receiving a large inheritance from an aunt. She said that aunt had passed away recently, and that with this money she could buy a house near Mark. After sending this message and multiple texts, Becky made it home, where she arrived at about 8:30 p.m. to be greeted by Keith. Only minutes later, her good friend Debbie Proctor paid her a visit as well, and Becky confided in her that she had just been out on a date. Keith, Becky, and Debbie sat out on the porch smoking and drinking tea until about a half hour had passed, at which point Becky decided abruptly to tell Debbie she needed to get going. Debbie, who had stayed till late a many a time, would normally be invited to sleep over at the couple's home on nights when it was too late to head back home. She had never before been asked to leave the house, and this struck Debbie as very strange indeed. Nevertheless, she obliged, and by 9:30, Debbie had headed out on her way back home. At 10:07, Becky placed a 911 call to say that some had broken into their home before shooting Keith and leaving once more. She stated that the intruder was in his 20s with blonde hair and a cute little face, and that he had come in to yell, "I'm sorry, but you should have hired me," before shooting him at point-blank range. She told police that she had followed the intruder out of the garage to discover a dark pickup truck leaving the scene. However, for someone who had witnessed her husband getting shot, Becky was acting very calmly. Instead of assisting and focusing her attention on the gunshot victim, She was found to be in the garage, just smoking when paramedics arrived. It was only after this that paramedics learned Keith was still breathing. He was unconscious, but still alive. He was transported off to the hospital, and the police went about investigating the crime scene. They began by telling Becky that they would need to test her for gunshot residue, a procedure that Becky laughed at and reduced to a lackluster CSI TV show reference before complying. It was also around the same time that Debbie received a call from Becky, saying that Keith had been shot and to come over. Debbie, who had driven the 2 miles toward home at about 9:30, had taken the time to wind down with a sandwich and with a dog walk before receiving the call. But she immediately got back on the road and grabbed Gloria on her way to pick up Becky and head to the hospital about an hour and a half after Keith had been transported. In the car, though, Becky seemed to be in high spirits. She was giggling on the way there, showing Debbie lewd pictures, one of a penis, after which Becky stated, "Can you believe I had sex with this today?" Becky was also calling people to tell them that Keith had in fact died and that they were planning a funeral, despite the fact that no one yet knew Keith's condition. They had yet to make it to the hospital, so as she drove, Debbie told Becky to shut up and to stop announcing Keith's death as if she knew. Soon afterward, Becky and the rest arrived at the hospital, and in the company of several friends and family, Becky received the news that Keith had, in fact, died. Only at this time did Becky suddenly give an emotional display in responses to Keith's fate. It was clearly not of import to her that Keith had died, only that she make an impression. Still, while Becky was at the hospital, detectives arrived and began to question her more carefully regarding the events that had transpired. The detectives asked about the so-called intruder that Becky claimed committed the crime, of whom Becky had too much to say. He was, in her words, a nice kid, a blonde about 25 years or so, wearing jeans and tennis shoes. She claimed that he wore a hoodie sweatshirt with the hood up, which begged the question, how did she know that he was blonde? She described his face as white, and it was during this interview that she also said he had a cute little face. She stated that during the encounter, she never felt afraid. Her behavior during this interview, though, was questionable at best. She was asked if the clothes she wore now were what she was wearing during the shooting, to which Becky responded yes. The police mentioned needing the clothes for evidence, and Becky immediately disrobed and threw her shirt at the detectives. She then started acting inappropriately toward the detectives in other ways, at one time telling a female detective that the detective had a cute butt and couldn't believe the guys weren't all after her. Her main concern during this interview, though, was even more disturbing. She stated she was worried about selling the house because Keith had been killed in the house. She didn't know if it would affect the value of it overall. To the detectives, this concern was overwhelming in its strangeness. For the spouse of a shooting victim, Becky seemed altogether different in both demeanor and speech. It was unnerving, to say the least. The police weren't the only ones to note Becky's strange behavior and to draw dark conclusions based on the thing that she'd done. Mark also heard of the murder, and something within him didn't sit right. He contacted the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation, which took up the case with gusto, and they knew from the police reports that something was definitely amiss in the Bryan household. When he reached out to the state officials, Mark had then asked to allow phone tapping and recorded calls for the duration of their new investigation. He agreed, and soon Mark was back in touch with his ex-lover, the woman who had once obsessively driven past his house in a fit of rage and estrangement. Becky was, of course, elated to hear from Mark, and more than that, she was eager to get him off the grid. During one of their phone calls, she demanded that he deny ever knowing her. She stated that he should not talk to police, nor to the media. There were other strange things about these phone calls, though. One particular oddity was that Becky told him that police had already found the suspect of the murder. According to Becky, the man she described had committed suicide, and the police, upon finding him, were able to find the murder weapon and easily clear Becky's name. There was, in her admission, no way that the police could find her guilty of the crime. But the fact was, no one in the investigation was keeping her posted. Due to the nature of the case, she didn't know that she was, in fact, a suspect, and there was no way she would know yet if they found one. In fact, the entire story was fabricated from head to toe in a cheesy and desperate effort to once again reel Mark in for herself. One final fact that Becky offered, which struck even the police as odd, was that Becky, who obviously had no knowledge of the crime scene reconstruction, claimed that she couldn't have done the deed because she was, in fact, right-handed. Never mind that the scenario she described didn't require any sort of hand preference in the shooter. The reconstructionist knew differently as well. In truth, the crime scene investigators learned a lot more from their work than Becky's story ever would tell them. It told them that Becky wasn't giving the whole truth of what happened, but it wouldn't be long before the truth would come to light, with or without her help. There was, for starters, the gunshot residue test, which Becky found funny. She stated that she knew how it worked, thanks to CSI, but what she didn't know was that it would easily test positive for GSR after it was checked. But that wasn't all. There were also her reactions during the initial response and investigation. Apart from her seeming indifferent to Keith's shooting upon the paramedics' arrival, Sergeant Collins responded to the scene to find that Becky had strange explanations for the shooting already. Namely, she suggested that the intruder who shot her husband was likely to be connected to a break-in at her son's home, where a gun was taken. During the investigation, she also briefly took to her bed, lying down and saying, "I can't do this." When Sergeant Collins initially asked her to stay out of the back porch, she rebutted to explain the gunshot residue that may or may not be found on her would have been from the dog, because the dog was the one in the room when Keith got shot. Becky also had differing statements, including one of which placed her in the garage, sitting on the love seat in there, when the intruder came in. Another statement, though, had her in the bedroom until she came out in the wake of a commotion to see the intruder. Becky's circumstances also pointed to a life plan gone awry. She claimed to have inherited an estate from her deceased aunt, which amounted to about $7 million. She also knew that one of her brothers received a family ring worth approximately $20,000 when the aunt passed. Although Becky claimed to have received such a robust inheritance, she still apparently had pitched a fit to her brother David, who eventually relinquished the ring to her to avoid the debacle. Clearly, there was more going on in Becky's life than the affairs, and with the calls she placed to Mark after the shooting. It became clear that Becky was hiding something. Becky Bryan was arrested for the murder of her husband only 3 days after the crime happened, and it wasn't hard to prove what had gone down that night. Given the statements and the evidence found at the crime scene, for one, the murder weapon was discovered at the scene of the crime, folded up in a blanket along with a shell casing and a left-handed rubber glove. These were found in the laundry room dryer, which was not inside the garage, and yet, according to every different statement, Becky insisted that the so-called intruder had come in and left through the garage. There would have been no chance for such an intruder to instead place the gun in the dryer, and so the suspicion was raised even more here to implicate Becky in the murderous crime. The blanket had 4 holes in it, consistent with the firing of a gun from inside the folded blanket. In addition, even though Becky claimed to be right-handed, the glove and the GSR found on her left hand further proved her involvement in the shooting. The glove found in the dryer even had a right-handed counterpart, found later inside the house upon further searching. And the pistol they found had matching ammunition and a matching Ruger pistol box underneath Becky's side of the bedroom mattress. Her ownership of the gun wasn't a secret, however, as Mark admitted to knowing about a gun that Becky kept in the glove compartment of her car. At the same time, her son mentioned believing that Becky still kept a handgun in her purse. Scientists did come back with results to match the Ruger found in the dryer to the box in the bedroom, as well as to indicate that it was, in fact, the weapon that shot through Keith's brain and hit a couch cushion behind him. Chief Medical Examiner Dr. Eric Pfeiffer also found that despite Becky's statement, the shooter was very close to Keith when they shot, causing severe brain laceration and ultimately death. The close contact wound contained and was surrounded by microscopic fibers, which were assumed to have to do with the blanket found with the gun. But Becky maintained her defense and her story all the way to court. After the arrest, it took 2 full days to pick a jury that would effectively deliver an unbiased trial for the woman awaiting verdict. The opening statements from the defense and the prosecution began on May 8th, 2 days after the trial began, May 8th, 2013, being Becky's 54th birthday. And what a gift she received. The Oklahoma woman persisted in her original story, pushing the defense attorney to argue that the nice, cute blonde boy intruder had in fact made his way into the house to shoot Keith before fleeing the scene. However, the prosecution had gained a full understanding of the affairs in which Becky had been engaging behind Keith's back, painting a portrait of a woman with a secret life and a secret motive for getting rid of her devoted husband. The defense rebutted this, further maintaining that Becky had no reason to kill Keith, as she could have divorced him at any time if she had wanted to leave. After all, she had gone through the process almost completely once. Who was to say that she wouldn't just use the same method again, should she get restless once again with her marriage? The defense also claimed that flirting with other men didn't warrant a murder conviction, and the defense pleaded with the jury to not pass judgment on Becky for her infidelity. While the prosecution provided the astounding amount of evidence showing Becky's connection with the murder, the defense in desperation claimed that the police had never believed that there was an intruder, giving no attention or inclination to investigate and look for said intruder, or the vehicle that Becky had described. But the point was moot. It was clear who had done the deed. It was clear who had killed Keith, and the jury agreed wholeheartedly. Becky was guilty of murder and sentenced to life without parole. Becky, for her part, appealed against the verdict, and the next year the appeal was altogether denied. No one was buying the story she had constructed, and she was done in for the devilry and deceit in one final swoop. It was clear straight away that something wasn't right to the people who knew the married couple. But what was unclear was why the snap occurred, why Becky, who had been the good girl, had broken like a twig to secrete a deadly sap. She not only changed her personality, but her entire world to fit the new goals she had set. It was clearly a dark time for her, and she had brought that darkness down slowly on everyone else in her life, until Keith, her final victim, was completely unsalvageable. It was with her actions, her last act of impassioned instability, that Becky broke the camel's back and sent herself into a vortex from which she will never fully escape. Her killer inclination, so to speak, sealed the darkness within her to a degree that will never fully be understood. It's through people like Becky that we discover the extents of delirium, of the masterful way in which a dangerous personality can convince others, and even themselves, that the world is theirs, that their actions are warranted, that they themselves are in some way sane. It's that delirium that turns a good girl or guy into the frightening and very real devil we know. Thanks once again for listening to Devil We Know. Our episode today was written by David Wayne Young and researched by Kat Morris of Active Shooter, the podcast. The intro music is courtesy of Chase, and as always, I am your host. Amanda was unable to record on this episode due to time constraints and her busy schedule. If you're thinking of supporting Devil We Know, a great way to do this is to visit devilwenowpodcast.com and click the donate button at the top of the page. Every little bit helps our show improve and create a long-lasting source of entertainment for you. Speaking of entertainment, if you're looking for ways to get the content our show makes, you can visit patreon.com/devilwenowpodcast to join the Circle of Hell. Right now, for only $1 a month, you can receive early release of episodes, a bonus 2 minisodes a month, Devil We Know stickers, and other exclusive features. We're always working to add more to this exclusive show for you patrons out there. Thanks again for listening, and remember, stay safe.